Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, several weeks ago, if you remember, Governor Kim Reynolds said she asked the Department of Human Services Director Jerry Foxhoven to resign because she said, in her words, she wanted to take the DHS in a different direction. Since then, there's been intense interest in finding out more about what's behind those words, take the DHS in a different direction, and more about this forced resignation in June. This week, we learned that Foxhoven is filing a whistleblower claim against the state and Governor Reynolds. Grant Gerlach is with us, IPR's Central Iowa reporter. Hi, Grant. You've been looking at it this week, haven't you?
Yeah. And Jerry spoke to the press yesterday, and this is the most we've heard from him really since the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us about what he did this week and what he had to say this week.
Yeah, well, he announced that he has plans to file this whistleblower claim, and so he had a meeting with press with his attorney at a West Des Moines law office, and basically he was there to lay out his side of what happened. And I'll try to give you the short version here. Basically, he says the governor's office was asking him to spend DHS money to pay the governor's deputy chief of staff. Now, he had approved an agreement to do this, to pay Paige Thorson is her name. He had signed an agreement to do this in the past, and he said he was okay with it then because at the time she was helping the new Medicaid director transition into the job. He was new to Iowa. She could show him the ropes. But at a certain point, she really wasn't working on Medicaid anymore, and he felt like it was no longer appropriate to continue the payments and may be illegal.
Mm. And he wanted to get an opinion from the attorney general, right?
Yeah. At first, he asked for an opinion from the governor's legal counsel. The governor's chief of staff, Sarah Craig Gongel, according to Foxhoven, said they weren't going to do that. And so he told her that he planned, told Gongel, that is, Craig Gongel, that he planned to ask the opinion from some assistant attorneys general who were working for DHS on a lawsuit. And before he had a chance to send them an email, they asked him to resign.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get Kim Reynolds' side. What does she say, her office say?
She's been saying a version of the same thing since the beginning, which is that there were many factors that went into her decision to ask Foxhoven to resign. Now, but there's the rub. The rub is that she says Foxhoven never raised any concerns about this budget arrangement to her or her staff. She also says that he never asked any of her staff for a legal opinion on the arrangements. Now, Foxhoven says that's not true. And the problem is we don't have any real hard evidence or documentation at this point. Who's telling the truth? Did he talk to her staff about it or not? He says he did not talk to Governor Reynolds about it directly, but he spoke to her chief of staff. The governor's office maintains that that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have this whistleblower claim against the state and Governor Reynolds. Does that lead to a lawsuit? What is the path?
It probably will. It may be years before that actually happens. But first it goes to the state appeal board. Foxhoven's attorney doesn't expect any resolution at the appeal board. After 6 months, they have the opportunity to withdraw their claim at the appeal board, and then they can file a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. So still we have this big quote from back in June to take the DHS in a different direction. Governor Reynolds discussed her decision to oust Jerry Foxhoven in a news conference. Really no more details, indications what might be the factors here besides what Jerry Foxhoven says?
Well, still a lot of questions. Did he really bring this issue before the governor's staff or not? And if he did, are they lying about not hearing about it? So he said he doesn't have any emails or documentation to show that he brought this issue before the governor's staff, which would be really helpful if you were trying to show it, even in a court of law. But they say they're going to build a circumstantial case around this. One thing he says stands on his side is that the governor's office has been asking DHS to take another look at these payments and make sure that they can be done appropriately in the future.
Okay. Grant Gerlach, IPR Central Iowa reporter. This mini saga continues, I guess.
It does.
Grant, we'll look to see how it unfolds in the coming weeks. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as a former school bus driver many, many years ago, I guess that would have been in the mid-1980s, this bit of news piqued my interest. This week, the Iowa State Board of Education adopted new rules that would require lap shoulder seat belts on all new buses bought by school districts and state-accredited non-public schools. Max Christensen joins us. He's Director of Transportation for the Iowa Department of Education. Hello, Max.
Well, good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Tell us more about the rules that were adopted.
Okay, the rules that were adopted, there's actually quite a series of rules that were adopted. Every 5 years, we update the specifications for school buses that are purchased here in Iowa. And anyway, there were a number of things that we updated and approved. But the biggest thing, of course, is the lap shoulder belts. And anyway, that's making quite a bit of news today.
Right. Okay. So this is only new buses, newly purchased buses. Why not buses that are running today?
Well, a number of reasons. Cost is one of the big issues. To retrofit a current bus would cost about probably $14,000 to $15,000 per bus. Mm-hmm. And when you go to retrofit a bus, it's not always the easiest thing to do because, especially with older buses, why the bracing underneath the bus itself, the seats themselves, even the attachment points inside the school bus are actually all different. So, I mean, it requires a great deal of work. And even once that you do retrofit a bus, it's probably still not as good as one that comes from the factory that way.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea here, Max, if I understand it, is to just let these older buses age out of the system, and in so many years we'll have buses that all have lap belts, shoulder
correct,
seat
yes.
belts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. How long before that would happen?
Well, you know, that's a guesstimate at best, I guess. Currently, the lifespan of a school bus in Iowa is approximately 15 years. So, you know, we could be looking at probably 15 years, although I'm hearing of a lot of school districts. In fact, I heard of several school districts just this week who had ordered new buses, and upon learning that this lap shoulder belt rule may very well pass, they actually called their dealer to change their order. Mm-hmm. So that their new buses, even though they don't have to meet it right now, that their new buses that they'll be getting would indeed have the lap shoulder belts. So
mm-hmm.
I believe that once the schools, you know, assuming the rule becomes effective, you know, we still have one more step to go, but assuming the rule becomes effective, once the schools start, you know, bringing these newer buses into their fleets, I believe that there will probably be some pressure from parents to update those buses a little more quickly.
On a new bus, you talked about retrofitting before, but on a new bus, what does it add to the cost of a new bus?
Well, it all depends on the size of the bus. Buses come pretty much in any size from about 12-passenger up to 84-passenger. So what we tend to look at is the cost per seating position. And anyway, the cost per seating position is $123.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so the most popular bus here in Iowa is a 65-passenger. So if you want to look at total cost on like a 65-passenger bus, it comes to right at $8,000.
Okay. School buses, as you and I know, Max, I know from, as I mentioned, the 80s, I was a school bus driver for a good year. School buses have lacked seat belts for decades. They've been the odd vehicles out. Everyone else required with seat belts. Why now? Where's the pressure coming from?
Well, I've been in the school bus business for 32 years myself, and quite frankly, this has been an argument within the industry itself for at least 30 to 40 years. And anyway, the reason is really starting to move forward now is back in 2007, there were several seat manufacturers that came out with what they call flexible seat belting. And anyway, what it does, it allows either two or three passengers in the same 39-inch seat, which is a standard seat on a school bus, and of course with the lap shoulder belts, why it's much more safe than what the old just standard lap belts were.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the concerns that and they were valid concerns in the past, of course, was the cost. The fact that you lost seating capacity, because typically you'd have to go down to a two-passenger seat instead of a three-passenger seat. And then, of course, the fact that with the old lap belts, the kids could use them as a weapon. You know, they could take them and whap the kid beside them on the head or something like that, you know.
Right.
And quite frankly, with the new flexible seating, the cost is coming down. The fact that you can put either two or three kids in the same seat. And then, of course, the lap belts themselves, I mean, it's just like what they are in your car. And I'm not going to say it's impossible for kids to use them as a weapon, but it's pretty darn hard because, you know, they're just like what are in your car. And, I mean, to try to, you know, grab that and try to whack somebody in the head would be pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So those three issues have been addressed. And again, the cost keeps coming down. And, you know, there are 8 states in the nation that currently require seat belts in their school buses. And also the National Transportation Safety Board, they came out a year ago in May. It would have been May of 2018. And they made the recommendation that all new school buses should have lap shoulder belts in them. And right here in the state of Iowa, the largest school district in the state, Des Moines, they on their own went ahead and tested these type of seats and belts on their school buses. And prior to us ever even moving forward on this rule, they went ahead and made the decision to equip all of their new buses with lap shoulder belts. So it's just one of those things that, you know, it's certainly moving forward and gaining a lot of momentum.
Now, of course, students, I imagine, will be then required to fasten their lap shoulder seat belts. How will the driver know?
Well, as a former school bus driver, I'm sure you remember looking in the big overhead mirror and
yes.
seeing the kids bouncing around and standing up and
mm-hmm.
and sometimes all over the school bus. And as a former school bus driver myself, I mean, it's pretty easy to tell when a child is not sitting forward or not sitting the way they should in a school bus. So I believe the drivers, I think it'll be fairly easy for them to tell when the kids are not using the belts as they should.
Okay. So when this is subject to a legislative review, do you see that as any sort of stumbling block that the legislature okays this?
Well, we're cautiously optimistic. The legislature's had a number of questions when we first gave notice of our rules to them back in, I believe it was in June, when we first spoke to the legislature about it. They had some very valid questions, and anyway, we've given them a great deal of information and passed along a number of training videos, accident videos, that sort of thing for them to look at. So we'll see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. What would you put at the top of the list of their concerns as you understand it?
Well, they were concerned about the cost and also what would happen if, a bus were to roll over and the kids were hanging from the ceiling or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, Max Christensen, thank you very much, Director of Transportation for the Iowa Department of Education, talking about new rules adopted this week by the Iowa State Board of Education that would require lap shoulder seat belts on all new buses bought by school districts and state-accredited non-public schools. And so with a review, Max, this could be in effect in the fall.
That is correct. It could go into effect as early as early October.
Max Christensen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some of the news that we missed or didn't cover in our other talk show hours this week to end the week. Well, how about this? A team of biomedical engineers, including a University of Iowa alumna, just won a $10,000 prize from Victoria's Secret. This is to honor their work designing a bra to help breast cancer survivors. Joining us, one of the award-winning team, Genevieve Goles. She's graduated from the University of Iowa in the spring of 2018, currently a laboratory technician with Medline Industries based in Chicago. Genevieve, are you there?
I am. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Thank you for joining us. Tell us.
Thank you for having me.
How did this project start?
So the Gamma Bra, our product, started off as a school project through the University of Iowa's College of Engineering senior design program. And so we basically had a full year to design a solution for women that suffer swelling that's a result of a mastectomy surgery.
Mm-hmm. So it's called a gamma bra. Why does the name have something to do with its function?
Actually, no. So the gamma bra, the name comes from all four of the team members. So I'm Genevieve, and then my other team members were Ashton, Moffer, and Anna.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you were given this. You were given this idea to identify an unmet need and then design a product to meet that need. That was given to the whole class, and your team picked this as an unmet need.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so explain a little bit more about how this bra helps breast cancer survivors.
So basically, the purpose of the bra is to provide a certain amount of compression around the surgical site and in the underarm areas. And this compression is needed to prevent any fluid buildup that is the result of a mastectomy surgery. What makes our bra different is that it only caters to women that get one breast removed or a unilateral mastectomy patient. Currently on the market, there are solutions that exist to prevent this issue called lymphedema for bilateral patients or women that get two breasts removed. So our task basically was to create a bra for women that get one breast removed to prevent any sort of swelling after surgery.
Mm-hmm. And how did you go about the design process that eventually led to your award-winning design? How did you start in thinking about this?
So we had a full school year to figure out our final solution. And we were basically just given the problem. We weren't given any sort of idea as to how to go about preventing this fluid buildup. We networked through the University of Iowa's hospitals and clinics to find professionals that have experience dealing with the issue of lymphedema. And we also had an advisor that was a physical therapist to help us basically come up with a tangible, good solution based on what's in the market already.
Mm-hmm.
So through the year, our design started off as just some fabric we bought at Joann's Fabrics. And throughout the year, we really tweaked different parts and different aspects of our fabric, and then our final prototype was actually repurposed extra large men's compression stockings that we bought at a medical supply shop in Coralville. Yeah, and so we were very fortunate in that, you know, since our seamstress skills were not up to bat, we were very fortunate in that the University of Iowa's theater department was generous enough to help us sew our final design.
The theater department.
And yes. So actually the seamstress that's responsible for making the costumes for the theater department for all their shows and things of the like helped us to sew our final product.
When you had your final design, did you test it? How did you test it? Did you test it on women who had lymphedema?
So actually, all of our testing occurred on a Frankenstein mannequin that we had. So we bought a mannequin off of Amazon and basically used wire cutters to remove one of the breasts. And then we filled it with self-expanding foam, dremeled it down, put some soft tape over it to simulate skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were able to fit our bra around the mannequin that we purchased.
Mm.
And then we had basically these really fancy sensors that were able to measure the amount of pressure that was being applied to each part of the body that we were concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So I understand all four in your design team, yourself included, have in your families been touched by breast cancer, and this was provided a big impetus, a passion for the project.
Absolutely, yes. And actually, in the process of creating our design, I got immense help from my grandmother, my paternal grandmother. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in December of 2015. Mm-hmm. And she was going through chemotherapy, radiation, and her cancer had come back in the middle of our design process. So she actually passed away in the middle of the in the development. And so before she had passed away, she provided very pivotal feedback on, you know, what breast cancer patients, what they might find comfortable after this sort of amputation surgery. Mm. And so, yeah, her help was immense to our progress and our development. Mm-hmm. So she passed away in February of 2018. And after that, it was very personally motivated that we had a successful product from my end. I know that my team members also had family members and friends who had either suffered through or passed away from breast cancer. So it was definitely, it was definitely motivated for them to get a good product, right? Mm-hmm. But
Genevieve, we have about a minute left. I want to find out.
Sorry.
No, you're good. I wonder. You've won the $10,000. Your team has won the $10,000 from Victoria's Secret. What will that $10,000 go for?
So we're using the $10,000 to file a patent with the United States Patent Attorney. Patent and Trademark Office. And so we actually got filed last Friday.
Excellent. Feedback, yes. Response. Have you been contacted by bra makers, for instance?
Not quite yet, but that's our next step in the process.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we're excited.
Well, it sounds exciting. Maybe someone listening out there has a connection there. We'll find out about this. Genevieve Goals, thank you very much. A graduate of the University of Iowa in biomedical engineering. Genevieve, part of a four-person team that designed an award-winning bra to help cancer survivors. What a story, Genevieve. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, a home state view of Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. Also, this is an interesting poll. I'll talk to Aaron Calvin of the Des Moines Register. What Iowans love most about Iowa? How would you answer that question? What do you love most about Iowa? We'll find out what these responses are afterwards. Also, Mark Simmet will be along with a preview of this weekend's Hinterland Music Festival. That's all yet to come on this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Glad you're aboard on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with Aaron Calvin of the Des Moines Register about what Iowans love most about Iowa. How would you answer that question? What you love most about Iowa? Could be anything, any category. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Also, a preview of this weekend's Hinterland Music Festival starting today through Sunday. But first, we continue our Home State View series, a series in which we look at 2020 presidential hopefuls with media professionals, journalists in their home state. Today, we focus on former U.S. Representative for Maryland and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. To do that, let's talk with Dominique Maria Bonesi, a Maryland reporter at WAMU in Washington, D.C. Dominique, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
So John Delaney's well known here, well known for being here for quite a while. Way back in 2017, he became the first Democrat to announce he was running for president. In 2017, to announce he's running for president in 2020, he did, I understand, right, not run for re-election to Congress representing Maryland in 2018. Take us back to John Delaney's earlier days. How did he rise in politics in Maryland?
So John Delaney was very not well known in Maryland prior to him running for office for his first time in 2012 for Congress. And he became known because 2 years before he got into Congress, the state Democrats, Maryland Democrats, had redistricted the whole state, the congressional districts. And part of that meant that the district that John Delaney was running for, District 6, which is from sort of Maryland, Montgomery County, which is a very blue district, to stretching out to Western Maryland, that stretches into West Virginia, which is a very red part of the state, they switched from red to blue. So, and John Delaney in 2012, when he ran, he beat out a 15-term Republican representative for Congress who had been there for years. So it was a really big turnover, and people started noticing, well, who is this guy? But it also, because, you know, it got the state on talking about gerrymandering, and that's actually something that's come up to the Supreme Court level now, where now we're talking, now a three-panel judge in 2018 has said that that gerrymandering that was done by Democrats was done to favor the Democrats. Mm-hmm. So that was something actually in Congress that John Delaney did say that he wanted to create a redistricting commission to make sure that states have fair redistricting. And that didn't actually really go anywhere in Congress.
Mm-hmm. In his time in Congress representing Maryland from 2013 to 2019, what do residents of Maryland know him for? What issues? What does he stand for as far as people of your state are concerned?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when asking a lot of people around, like, people don't really remember exactly one thing that he did in Congress. People do know about the redistricting stuff, but I mean, that's really it. He's kind of an unknown factor here when it comes to what he did in Congress. And what I think you really need to look at is what he did before he even got into politics.
And that was?
And that was actually, in 1993, after he graduated with a law degree from Georgetown University, he opened his first company. It was called Healthcare Financial Partners. It lent money to small hospitals and healthcare providers. And then in 1999, he sold that for $30 million. So he is really a millionaire. I mean, I think it was 2015 in Congress, he was the third wealthiest member with a net worth of $230 million.
Hmm. Tell us, what can you tell us about the people he surrounds himself with, his team?
So his team is pretty much staffers who he's worked with already while he was in Congress. So there's a lot of rapport already built there with them. And as of recently, it turns out that some of his senior staffers have been telling him that he should actually withdraw from the 2020 race.
Mm-hmm. Which advice, which he evidently has ignored.
Right.
Okay. So we like to find out with these home state views how the candidate has dealt with criticism in the past. What can you say about that?
Well, I mean, if we want to look, at his record before entering politics, his uncle, John Rowe, who's a professor of healthcare policy at Columbia University, called him, someone who really was able to take criticism and do his homework and learn mm-hmm. from what people were telling him. Now, the whole example of him not taking advice from his staffers to drop out of the race might speak otherwise. And then we also have that he also on stage, I believe this past week, we saw him with Elizabeth Warren. We saw the whole when he was basically saying that we need to we can't have Medicare for all. I'm a moderate and Medicare for all. And Elizabeth Warren came out, and we keep replaying this on NPR. We
right.
keep hearing that, why do we do this? Why does someone run for president if they think we can't do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, and his face in that moment, we didn't get to hear a follow-up from him, but, I think it definitely speaks to the fact that he sometimes doesn't always get the chance to respond to that criticism.
Right. I wonder what the people around you in Maryland think of John Delaney in the spotlight. He's, as I mentioned at the outset, he was the first Democrat to announce running for president way back in 2016. 17. He's done, I don't know if you know what this is, doing all 99 counties in Iowa is called doing the full Grassley, Dominique.
Because I did not know that.
Yes, our senator makes a point of doing that to keep in touch with all of his constituents. So what do Marylanders think of John Delaney here in Iowa and running for president?
You know, with his three terms in Congress and really, you know, he wasn't born in the state. He was actually born in New Jersey. He really doesn't have a strong following other than the district that he was from in Maryland. But if you ask people in Maryland who they would have thought was going to run for president, they would have said Governor Larry Hogan, who you probably saw on Late Night with Seth Meyers yesterday. He was making the rounds on some other news shows, national news shows yesterday. You know, we, as a state, we're a very moderate state, and Governor Hogan has really put himself there. And so this sort of juxtaposition between John Delaney and Governor Larry Hogan is one that a lot of people weren't expecting John Delaney to run, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we like to find out about candidates from their home states, something that we might not have reported on, or the national media might not have reported on, a lesser known fact about John Delaney?
I can tell you two. So one, he's an avid gym rat. He, you know, works out a lot, likes to stay fit. Apparently, there are some people saying he's the fittest person on the debate stage. Mm-hmm. And then another interesting fact, which is might be a little well-known, but maybe less well-known, was his take on immigration. He talks about accepting all people to be allowed to be immigrating to this country. And he refers to the story of his grandfather coming into Ellis Island in 1923. Apparently, his grandfather had lost one of his arms in childhood. Mm. And when you came into Ellis Island, they put you aside because, you know, because you're disabled, it might not allow you to enter the country. So he was separated from his family and put into sort of a holding room before a judge could come in and determine whether he could be allowed into the country. The judge came in, and turns out the judge had one arm as well, and said, yeah, go ahead, kid. So that's wow. Kind of a fun story I thought of, just his take on immigration and what he thinks about it. It gives you a little insight into his values as well.
Indeed. Dominique Maria Bonesi, Maryland reporter at WAMU in Washington, D.C., with a home state view of Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. Dominique, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if you're an Iowan, most of the people listening to my voice, I assume, are Iowans. What if I asked you what in particular you love about your home state of Iowa? That's exactly what the Des Moines Register did recently with some interesting results. Joining us now to tell us about that, Aaron Calvin is a reporter with the Des Moines Register. He covers trending news for the Register. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi. So set the scene here. What did you set out to do here?
So at the Register, we've been attempting to see what our readers think about certain things and then report on those things. Something that we did before this was we had our readers tell us about their favorite gas stations in the state, which was actually a lot of fun. And people rated, you know, their favorite gas station food, who has the best soda selection, stuff like that. So with this, we decided that we wanted to see, you know, what Iowans love about Iowa with so much attention on the state right now and the caucuses coming up. So we sent out the survey and asked our readers to respond, and we got a lot of responses.
How many responses, roughly?
I would say somewhere around 100.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you in the for the sake of building some suspense to keep the number one response off to the side for a moment. One response rose above the rest, according to your article. We'll put that to the side, let that suspense build, and talk about some of the other things that your readers, poll responders, said. Pick one that you thought was surprising or illustrative of Iowans.
Something that that I thought was kind of surprising that we got several responses on was that people claimed to really enjoy the Iowa seasons specifically. And I think that, you know, maybe because this survey was sent out in July, that people were feeling more appreciative about the four seasons in Iowa. But I thought that was especially interesting Mm-hmm. And people responded a lot with different foods that you can only get in Iowa that they really liked, and we kind of grouped that together in one section. But, you know, everybody loves Casey's Pizza, A&E, food products, you know, the kind of stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And then as soon as you're outside of Iowa, kind of you realize that, you know, how special those kinds of things are.
Right. And I see sweet corn on the list there, too. We have prime time for sweet corn. I have to pick up some more after work. I've got a wonderful sweet corn stand on the way home on my bike, and they pick it in the morning, and it's there the rest of the day. That is the way to eat it. Okay, so I see also on your list the land. The land is what people love.
Yeah, you know, and this is a kind of summation of a lot of varied responses that we got. People talked about loving the smell of the air and the open lands, the quiet of the countryside. The beauty of the Iowa countryside that, you know, takes various shapes in certain parts of the state, but is really unique to Iowa. And, you know, people really seem to value that in Iowa, and they really seem to think that it's what sets it apart from a lot of other states.
Mm-hmm. As far as events, your respondents named the Iowa State Fair. No surprise there, coming up on our Iowa State Fair time. But also, last week we had RAGBRAI. That ranked up there. Was that any sort of surprise?
No, I mean, there's little in Iowa, I think, that's more Iowan than riding a bike. And RAGBRAI really kind of pushes that kind of feeling and the kind of community that bike riders in the state have, and it's kind of the pinnacle of all of that. And also, I think it does have to do, it ties in with the other answer that we just talked about, you know, loving the land in Iowa, and there's no better way to kind of see that land than from, you know, atop a bicycle crossing the entire state. So, you know, that there's a reason it's such a big tradition along with the state fair. Right. In Iowa, and I think it's just because people, you know, like it so much.
Right, and I can testify to that, having returned from my fifth trip across the state on a bike on RAGBRAI just last week. Okay, drum roll. Let's get to number one. You said one response rose above the rest. It was?
The people.
What about the people did you get responses about?
You know, some people just responded by saying that the people were their favorite. Some people kind of, you know, elaborated. One respondent, Sophia Coker Gunnick, she said that she, you know, she lived abroad for a while and she knew that she was back in Iowa when she stopped at Hy-Vee and a cashier asked her about her day, which, you know, is not something that happens everywhere. There's a certain feeling of community that is, I think, special to Iowa, and you know, a certain neighborliness that people experience, whether they lived here for a year or their entire lives, mm-hmm. That really makes an impression.
Right, and the quote you include in your article from Jim Swearjen, an Iowan. I just want to read the first part of it. We have to go here in just a moment, but his words speak to this point of the people of Iowa being so special. I love the people. More often than not, when you wave at a stranger, you'll get a wave back. If you break down on the side of the road, several people will stop to offer help. I love the fact if you drop something valuable, most times somebody will run down to get it back to you. So that sums it up as well, very much. So, Aaron Calvin, plenty of other things to check out in your article as you looked at what in particular Iowans love about Iowa. Aaron Calvin, reporter for the Des Moines Register, covering trending news for the Register. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, hey, if you're looking for something to do today, also through the weekend, through Sunday, it's the annual Hinterland Music Festival being held at the Avenue of the Saints Amphitheater in St. Charles, Iowa. That's just south of Des Moines. Boy, this festival has really taken off since it was first held in 2015, now expanded to 3 days this year. Hinterland is an Iowa Public Radio supporter, and IPR is a Hinterland sponsor. Mark Simmet is there, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Mark, you've really been busy.
Oh, yes, I'll be going up and down those hills at that amphitheater all weekend long.
Okay. It's expanding this year, I hear, from 2 to 3 days. So many acts as I look at the lineup for today, Friday, on to Saturday and Sunday. We don't have a lot of time, but I want to make sure our listeners know you can check it all out at hinterlandiowa.com, how you attend, ticket prices, and, of course, all the acts. We have a few minutes, Mark, to end this hour. Give us some music that will be heard over those rolling amphitheater hills.
Yeah, well, there's 22 acts appearing, so, you know, obviously we can't cover everybody. So I just picked a couple headliners and one that I am especially looking forward to, and the one I'm especially looking forward to is the Wood Brothers. And we have a track here from that band, which is the brothers, Chris and Oliver Wood. The thing about them is the songs that they write sound like they could be traditional songs, which is a really great quality. They're fine players, Oliver Wood and his brother Chris Wood, who's also in Modesky, Martin and Wood, is an accomplished bass player. They're going to be a great addition to the festival. Here's Shoe Fly Pie.
I'm going to give you the wheel. I'm going to let you drive. But you got to make me a shoe fly pie. You got to make me a shoe fly pie. Don't forget the sweet molasses. I won't leave a crumb. Don't you just sit there laughing when you know how bad I need some. You know how bad I need some of that shoe fly pie. Shoe fly pie. Shoe fly.
The Wood Brothers Shoe Fly Pie. I love it. Mark, what else you got for us that will be at the Hinterland Music Festival this weekend?
One of the headliners, Jason Isbell and his band, the 400 Unit, very respected Americana singer-songwriter, started out in the Drive-By Truckers band. He's been a solo artist since 2007 and started this group, the 400 Unit, shortly after his solo career began. Latest album called The Nashville Sound did quite well for him. In fact, won a Grammy for Best Americana Album in its year of 2017. Here's Cumberland Gap.
Music of Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, the Cumberland Gap, the name of that tune. Jason appearing Saturday at the Hinterland Music Festival. Hey, Mark, I think we have time for one more, also to take us out, this News Buzz edition of River to River. What else do you have for us?
We have Brandi Carlile. She is returning to the festival, and this time she's a headliner. In fact, she's closing out the entire festival Sunday night. She'll be the final act. Brandi Carlile, great performer, and here's one from her called Mainstream Kid.
Mark Simmet giving us a taste, a little taste of the many acts that will be today through Sunday at the Hinterland Music Festival at the Avenue of the Saints Amphitheater in St. Charles, Iowa. Find out more information at hinterlandiowa.com. Mark Simmet, you'll be there, right?
Oh, yes, the entire weekend we're going to be there. IPR will be there. Stop by and say hello at our booth, and maybe we will see you.
Okay, well, let's continue to go out with Brandi Carlile, Mainstream Kid. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend, whether at Hinterland or wherever. Thanks for joining us.
The class.